Please rise. Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Larkin, Chief Judge Clary, Judge Halbrooks, the Honorable Michelle A. Larkin presiding.
Good morning. Next case on our calendar is State of Minnesota versus David Nielsen. We're hearing this case by Interactive Television this morning. Who is appearing for Mr. Nielsen?
Gina Schultz, the State Public Defender's Office.
And just so we make sure we have everyone we need, could the attorney who's representing the state say a few words so we make sure we're picking you up?
Yes, this is Bonnie Thayer, Assistant St. Louis County Attorney.
All right, it looks like we can see both of you when you speak, so we're ready for arguments, and Ms. Schultz may begin.
May it please the court, my name is Gina Schultz, Assistant State Public Defender, and I represent David Nielsen, the appellant in this matter. Mr. Nielsen's conviction of ineligible person in possession of a firearm must be reversed because it rests on circumstantial evidence that does not eliminate all reasonable inferences that are consistent with innocence and inconsistent with guilt. Specifically here, the circumstances proved do not eliminate the alternative hypothesis that the gun was owned by the same person who owned the truck, and Mr. Nielsen never consciously exercised dominion or control over it.
Counsel, can we separate those two concepts? Because I have a hard time understanding if he was consciously exercising dominion and control over the gun, does it matter that he didn't own the gun?
No, not at all. I mean, he could certainly exercise dominion and control over a gun that wasn't his. But the alternative hypothesis is that the gun belongs to the woman who owns the truck, that she put it there, and that he didn't disturb it.
Okay, so your argument is really that, well, you're saying he didn't disturb it. I mean, if he gets into the truck, the gun is there, it's not his gun, he didn't put it there, he doesn't disturb it, but he knowingly drives the truck with the gun in the back. Isn't that an exercise of dominion and control?
Perhaps under those facts.
Okay.
If he sees the gun before he starts driving, but here the alternative hypothesis captures a couple of different situations. One is that he never even sees the gun because it's dark out, the truck is full of miscellaneous items. We don't have any pictures of the truck, but we know that there's quite a bit of stuff in there because the police officers both testify that this long hunting rifle was covered way up to its buttstock. So a very long hunting rifle is almost covered in other things. So we know it's a pretty full truck.
It seems to me that to win this argument, it would have to be based on a conclusion that he did not know, or it's reasonable to believe he did not know the gun was there. So there was no knowing and conscious exercise of dominion and control.
I disagree with that.
Okay.
That's certainly one alternative hypothesis under which we win. But as I argued in my brief, even if he's driving along, he sees the gun at some point. If he thinks, oh, no, I wish this gun weren't there, because if I get pulled over and someone sees it, I'll be in trouble. That's the opposite of exercising dominion or control over an item.
Unless he keeps driving, how does that theory play out if he looks back, sees the gun, and he continues on his way knowing that the gun's in the car?
Well, if he stopped and took the gun out, he would unambiguously be violating the statute by being in physical possession of it.
What if he stopped and called the person who owns the truck and says, hey, you got to come get your truck. There's a gun in here. I can't be anywhere near a gun.
I mean, that is certainly something he could have done. But what matters is whether he had this mind state of consciously exercising dominion or control. And the state just didn't prove that here under these facts.
Can I ask another question? In your brief, you seem to argue that in order to prove constructive possession at a time when the defendant does not have actual or physical possession of the gun, the state needs to prove that, in fact, the defendant did have actual physical possession of the gun at some point previously. And that seems to come from the language in Florine describing the purpose of the constructive possession doctrine. Is that all you're relying on for the notion that prior actual possession is an element of a constructive possession case?
I'm principally relying on that language, but I think that principle is played out in the cases that are that have been decided under this statute, such as in Harris and Sam.
Were those just? But in Harris and Sam, there was no evidence that the defendant actually physically possessed the gun that was discovered in those cars or guns. Excuse me.
That's true. There were not in those cases.
Because as I look through the case law, which was summarized nicely by this court in an unpublished case in 2017, it seems to me that when there's a situation where the evidence shows that the defendant actually possessed the item, so you've got an informant who saw the defendant with the item or a police officer who saw the defendant with the item, that we treat those cases just as actual possession cases and not constructive possession cases. And then the one case you've cited, wasn't really a case where they had, you know, evidence of actual possession and then they tried to follow up with a constructive possession theory. So I'm just not sure that actual possession is a necessary element of a constructive possession case.
I mean, under the language of Florine, it is, if that's the purpose of the statute. I mean, I don't think this statute is trying to get at situations where a defendant is in proximity to a gun and has knowledge of that gun. The idea is that they did physically possess it, or that they at least exercised conscious dominion or control.
But in Florine, was there any evidence? My recollection of Florine is the, I don't know if it drugs or gun, it was found in the car. The defendant was nowhere near the car. Was there any proof that he had previously physically possessed the item?
Well, in Florine, they looked at the car and there were many other items in the car, and they all were very clearly traced back to the defendant. So his ID was there. I believe his homework was in there.
But does that prove that he actually possessed it? No one saw him with the item. That just proves that his stuff was in the car with the contraband,
sure, creates a
constructive possession, I think.
But in that case, that creates a very strong inference that he was the one who put the gun in the car. And, you know, in this case, there could have been, if Nielsen were guilty, there could have been evidence that, or sufficient evidence that he was the one who placed the gun in the car. Say, if his things were found all around the gun, or if his DNA was found on the gun, if his fingerprints were found on the gun. The state does know how to prove constructive possession cases, and that's what they do. But here we don't have any. We know that there was clothing surrounding the gun, but the police officers did not investigate whether it was male clothing or female clothing. They didn't follow up with the woman who owns the car to see, or the truck, to see, is this your gun? If she would have said, hey, this isn't my gun, that's a pretty strong inference then that Nielsen was the person who physically placed the gun in the car. But we don't have any of that evidence here. We don't have any indication that he wanted the gun there, that he put it there, or that he was in any way exercising dominion or control over it. Since we started talking about Sam and Harris, there are some really similar facts in those cases. In Harris, it was dark out, the gun was concealed, there's a little bit of the gun sticking out. The police officer said, I identified this as a gun, but the Supreme Court pointed out that there's no evidence that a layperson would identify it as a gun. And that's kind of the same situation we have here, where we have butt stock of a gun sticking out. The police officer says that they identified the gun, but there's no evidence that Nielsen saw it, that he knew about it, that he moved it.
But there were, both in Sam and Harris, there were other people in the car, right?
True, but in Sam, this court pointed out that there are two alternative hypotheses. One is that that it belonged to the other passenger, but the other was that it belonged to the person who owned the car. And so here, we don't have another passenger, but we still have that other hypothesis, which is that it belonged to the person who owned the car.
And the substance in Sam was concealed in the glove compartment.
The glove compartment and the center console.
As opposed to just right there in the back seat, sticking out of some clothes.
Yeah, and I believe in this case it was in the front seat. And it was a foot from his hand. We have all that testimony, and we defer to that on review. But it was dark. The truck is full of stuff. Nielsen certainly showed some signs of impairment. At least he had dilated pupils. He's sweaty. It's at least enough for the arresting officer to subject him to field sobriety tests. So there's really enough evidence in the there's not enough evidence in this record to preclude the notion that he never even saw this gun.
You've mentioned a couple of times that it was dark. Is there anything in this record to establish when he began driving this truck? I mean, for example,
no,
in
not.
The daylight as opposed to in the evening? We have nothing.
No, there's not. Yeah. And again, that's something that the state could have potentially proven by calling the woman who owned the car and saying, when did you give him this car? Was it, you know, put some kind of timeline on this. Instead, all we have is the state of the truck at 1 a.m. and speculation about whether he did or did not possess this gun.
But it is established in the record, Ms. Schultz, that this gun stock was in the front passenger seat.
Yes, it was in the front passenger seat. And, you know, the state makes the argument that because the prescription bottles and his ID were found elsewhere in the truck, that you know, is similar to fluorine, that it associates the truck with his property. But we don't have any testimony about where the bottles and the ID were found. They could have been in the back. It was an extended cab pickup. It could have been in the driver's side door. It could have been anywhere. And so it doesn't really add anything to the state's case that, you know, we know Nielsen was there. So it's not surprising that some of his property was also there. And I also want to address the other potentially bad fact for him, which is that he gave a false name to police. And the jury, I'm sure, inferred that he was doing so to evade detection for the gun. But on these facts, that's not the only available inference. We know that he is exhibiting signs of impairment with his dilated pupils and sweatiness. And we know that the officer subjected him to field sobriety tests. And we know from the complaint that he was charged with a number of other offenses, including driving after cancellation and fifth degree drug possession. And so viewing these circumstances as a whole, it's just not enough to prove that he knew about the gun, that he possessed the gun, that he ever wanted to exercise dominion or control over the gun. And I briefly want to address the final argument that I made in my brief, which is that I think some more language of Lorien that is a little confusing. Under Florian's articulation of the constructive possession doctrine, it says that the second prong is that the state needs to prove beyond a reasonable doubt a strong probability that the defendant that just doesn't make sense with the state's constitutional obligation to prove every element of the offense beyond a reasonable doubt.
Counsel, that is a good point, but does that matter if it's a case where the evidence actually shows beyond a reasonable doubt that there was an exercise of dominion and control? In other words, if you take that substantial basis out, do we have any concern? Or it's just having that language embedded in the factor?
Well, it's certainly my position that there's not enough evidence to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt here. And so the only reason I'm concerned at all with this language is that even if it's hasn't been proved beyond a reasonable doubt, that if the state has, you know, proved a strong probability, that's just not enough. Which is why brought that up in my brief. In the end, the state just didn't do enough to prove constructive possession here. The knowledge and proximity are just not enough. If I go to my grandpa's house where he has all of his hunting rifles in a case. I haven't constructively possessed those guns, even though I know that they're there. I'm right there. I'm right next to them. It's not enough under Florian. It's not enough under the constructive possession doctrine. And here, there's just the state hasn't presented enough to prove that he was anything more than close, and at best that he knew the gun was there, even though these circumstances did not even preclude that that inference. So unless the court has any questions, we ask that this court reverse Mr. Nielsen's conviction.
Thank you for your arguments. Ms. Thayer?
Good afternoon. Bonnie Thayer on behalf of the state or respondent. Appellant's argument is that the circumstantial evidence in this case can also point to a theory that's inconsistent with guilt. However, the state's position is that even if someone else owns the gun, if we're making that assumption, appellant can still be in constructive possession of the gun, and that would not be inconsistent with guilt in the finding of the jury in this case. Specifically, so as already discussed by appellant, possession can be actual or constructive, and given that actual possession involves direct control over something, in this case, appellant was not found by law enforcement with the gun on his person, so the state has focused on the constructive possession doctrine, which the state has proved beyond a reasonable doubt, given that the firearm was found in a place to which others have access, there was a strong probability that he at the time was consciously exercising dominion and control over it. Specifically, in reviewing the totality of the circumstances here, the state proved constructive possession at the time he was arrested, given that the firearm was in a truck that was driven solely by the defendant. There were no other occupants of the truck. Further, there were other personal belongings of the appellant in the truck, specifically his wallet and prescription bottle. They were located in the truck and not on his person. The firearm specifically was a long gun, making it more visible, and it was located in the passenger seat of a small pickup truck. The testimony was that this was a Dodge Dakota pickup truck, and it was described as small. And the evidence further indicated from the testimony of Officer Allen that the firearm would have been located approximately 1 foot from the appellant's hand when he was seated in the driver's seat. The evidence also indicates that the long gun was visible from the driver's seat and outside of the pickup truck. So despite the fact that this was nighttime, the long gun was visible to law enforcement outside of the pickup truck. Additionally, appellant's furtive movements and the fact that he was sweaty and had dilated pupils and lied about his identity could indicate to the jury that he knew he was doing something illegal. And so looking at the totality, the appellant's close proximity, and the fact that he was transporting the firearm and no one else was transporting the firearm, the state has proved beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant or appellant knowingly possessed the firearm on May 17th of 2017, especially reviewing the evidence in the light most favorable to conviction.
Counsel?
But to counsel? Prove this, yep.
Did Sandra Klepper, the owner of the vehicle, testify?
She did not testify.
Did a statement ever taken from her?
Not to my knowledge, okay. No. Thank you. And to prove its case, the state did use circumstantial evidence. And when reviewing the sufficiency of circumstantial evidence, this court is to identify the circumstances proved and also determine whether those circumstances are consistent with guilt and inconsistent with any rational hypothesis except that of guilt. And so in addition to the circumstances that I just discussed, there's also the fact that the registered owner of the truck is someone other than the appellant. And appellant points to this one fact and argues that that makes a rational hypothesis inconsistent with guilt, specifically that the firearm belonged to the owner of the truck, and appellant never consciously exercised dominion and control over it. However, the fact that someone else is the registered owner of the truck does not negate the fact that the circumstantial evidence is only consistent with appellant exercising dominion and control over the firearm. We know that the registered owner was not exercising exclusive control over the firearm at that point in time on May 17th of 2017, as appellant was the only one in the truck and he was driving the truck. Appellant cites to the Harris and Sam cases as factually relevant. However, in both of those cases, the contraband, I believe it was a controlled substance, was hidden from view, so it was possible that the appellant or the defendant in those cases did not know it was there or that it existed. And additionally, there were other occupants in those vehicles, so other people or other individuals had the opportunity to exercise dominion and control over those controlled substances or contraband. And so the circumstantial evidence in the Sam and Harris case could have equally applied to other passengers in the vehicle. That's just not the case here. Appellant was the driver and sole occupant. The evidence proves that the firearm would be visible to the person in the driver's seat and was 1 foot from the appellant's hand. And constructive possession can be exclusive or joint. So appellant can still exercise dominion and control over a firearm that is owned by somebody else. In this case, even if the firearm was owned by the registered owner of the truck, that is not inconsistent with guilt because the appellant was still exercising dominion and control in that truck on May 17th of 2017. And if the court doesn't have any questions for me, I don't have anything further.
Court has no questions. Thank you for your argument.
Thank you.
Ms. Schultz, do you have a rebuttal argument?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. I have just a couple of points to make following counsel's argument. One is that I don't disagree with a lot of what opposing counsel has said. Certainly, we don't dispute that these circumstances support the state's theory of the case. And in some ways, the facts are basically undisputed, besides the fact that, besides the knowledge element.
And do you agree that the gun was on the floor of the front passenger seat, leaning up against the passenger seat?
Okay. Yes. Yeah, the testimony is that the barrel was on the floor, and then the buttstock was leaning on the passenger seat, and it was only the buttstock that was sticking out of the pile of miscellaneous items.
But then it would have been right next to the driver.
Yeah, the testimony is that it was a foot from his hand. But the only thing I disagree with the county attorney about is that those are the only inferences we can draw. The state is right that we rely pretty heavily on the fact that this is not his car, but that's because it's a very big fact. If somebody is driving up to us in another person's car and you just had to guess who owns all of the things in the car, you're just at a 50-50. It could be the person driving. It could be the person who owns the car. And in this case, the state just didn't present enough evidence to get over that 50-50 hurdle and to get to beyond a reasonable doubt. Mr. Nielsen's alternative hypothesis incorporates all of the circumstances proved. We don't have any direct evidence that he saw the gun. We have evidence that he was perhaps impaired, which would mean that he might not be as attentive as other drivers. It's dark, and the gun is buried up to its buttstock. But as I argued previously, even if he had knowledge, even if he acquired knowledge at some point, that's not enough under the constructive possession doctrine, just proximity and knowledge. If he doesn't want that gun there, and he's wishing that it weren't there because he knows it could get him in trouble, which is a very likely scenario, he's not possessing that gun. He's not exercising dominion or control. And we don't dispute that the gun could be constructively possessed by the owner and Mr. Nielsen at the same time. But there's just not evidence that it happened here. Or maybe there's evidence to support that inference, but this court doesn't defer to the jury's choice between inferences. And when the inference that it was Ms. Clapper's gun, that she placed it in her truck, and that he didn't see it or didn't disturb it, never handled it, didn't exercise dominion or control, that is an alternative hypothesis that is based on the circumstances proved. And because the state didn't eliminate that alternative hypothesis, Mr. Nielsen's conviction must be reversed. And if the court has any other questions, I'm happy to answer them.
No questions. Thank you for your argument.
All right, thank you so much.
The case is submitted. That concludes the court's calendar this morning.